intellectually petty, radio on your stereo. Don't compare us to anything, this a different scenario. We break records while we pushing the culture forward. Great music and big vibes right in that order. Intellectually petty, radio on your stereo. Don't compare us to anything, this a different scenario. We break records while we pushing the culture forward. Great music and big vibes right in that order.
And you are now tuned into another episode of Intellectually Petty Radio, brought to you by M3S3 Clothing. Men make moves and suckers stand still. And as always, on the mighty, mighty, mighty Nerd DJs Radio Network. And you already know, I only rock with legends over here. And today, first off, it's 9 o'clock in the morning. I never do a show at 9 o'clock in the morning. But when you have one of the most important politicians of her generation, you wake up when she tells you to wake up. It's that serious. So we got mother, wife, lawyer, proud member of the Divine Nine. Did not know that until today. Shout out to the Zetas. The first Palestinian American woman to serve in Congress. A staunch defender of human rights. U.S. Representative for Michigan's 12th Congressional District. Representative Rashida Tlaib. Good morning and how are you?
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me. I'm good. Dropped off my baby boy, my boys in school and came rushing back so I can do this 9 o'clock interview with you. But no, thank you for inviting me. Thank you for having me.
Oh my goodness. Come on now. It's a complete honor. I've been looking forward to this literally since she said it was a go. And how's the family? I ask everybody.
Good. My eldest is going off to college this coming fall. So excited about that. But I have a 13-year-old and an 18-year-old now. But they're good. It's good to be, you know, we have moments where we're not in Washington, D.C. We're doing what they call in-district work periods. Mm-hmm. And so we're in the district. I was just yesterday at school in Mary Grove Elementary School talking to the kids there about my grandmother, but also, you know, just having them participate in like what it, you know, if you were a member of Congress for a day, what kind of bills would you work on? Of course, they brought up gun violence, healthcare. I love this. One young lady said, well, we got to do something about the cost of groceries. You know, Costco, get it? Costco. I was like, she's third grader. And I was like, I guess I was trying to. But it, in all seriousness, they were just incredible. I mean, one kid did say no school on Monday. I said, that's not going to happen. But it's always really good to come home and be with, you know, the people that inspire you.
I'm curious. You've been doing this for a while. First, you were in the Michigan House, and then you went to the U.S. House. Did you anticipate all the hate and the venom? Is it worth it?
No, I didn't. And I don't know. I mean, I've got to ask this question, and I'm honest about it. If I knew what would happen. I mean, my first day, I remember my first day of orientation. That's before I got sworn in. That's before I said, hey, impeach him, anything. I had just gotten elected. And right after you get elected in November, about a week later, they contact you and say, you got to come in. It's like a 2-week orientation. And so all of us new members, we're like the largest incoming historic class to Congress, the most diverse, you know, first Native American, first Black woman to ever represent the state. I mean, things like that. So just all array of beautifulness that is coming in. And I remember it was the first day of orientation and I'm about to go onto the bus to take us back to the hotel. And as I'm getting up there, my chief of staff says, hey, can you come to the side? I just got a call. You know, just want you to know they have a valid threat. Capitol Police and FBI and everybody's working on it. They're going to pay this person a visit. And it was just at that moment, I was just so shocked because I didn't have to say anything. It was just my mere existence. I don't know if it was because I was Muslim, if it was because I was unapologetically, you know, in opposition to fascism and the racist in chief, or, you know, being Palestinian. I don't know what it was that triggered this person. And I always wonder, but it was eye-opening, because at that very moment I thought to myself, I didn't even do anything. I didn't introduce a bill. I didn't do anything just of yet, but just, it sunk in that my mere existence is a threat to people.
What's that conversation like with your family?
It's hard. I don't know how to explain it to folks. Like, what do you tell your kids? I mean, at that time they were much younger. That was 6 years ago. I know recently, because of everything happening in Gaza, it got worse than I've ever had in any of my whole career. Mm-hmm. And so we had to have security around the clock for like 3 days, because it was so much threats coming in. No one knew the capacity of trying to track it, figure it out. I remember somebody threatening on Twitter, some Twitter conversation of, you know, how far do you have to be to shoot her? Wow. And, you know, they had to file like a war, you know, Twitter or X wouldn't provide the information for that user. And so, you know, people at the U.S. Attorney's Office, everybody had to get involved to pull the data, like file warrants to be able to get the data and find out who this gentleman is. So all that to say is, you know, that one moment, my then 12-year-old goes, Mom, what's going on? Like, this is the first time they've seen that, right? They see people kind of picking me up sometimes and somewhat be in the background, but they've never felt it, this amount of presence. And sometimes I have to explain, you know, like, mommy's work is sometimes really hard because it's changing positions that have been so embedded in our country that, you know, mommy being a Muslim, mommy being unapologetically against genocide, or speaking about Palestinians in a way in Congress that has never been spoken about. Or I tell them, like, you know, the way I come after, I don't like saying their names, but the guy in Florida where he's like trying to take Rosa Parks out of our history books and calling out for what it is, you know, white supremacy. As soon as I say that, people just get all like, you know, reactionary. And it's like, it's very telling on them more than us. But, you know, I'm trying to explain to them of me being part of, I think, a movement in our country of saying, you know, Congress shouldn't just look differently, but it should feel and speak differently. And that's very threatening to some people that don't want to see people like us in Congress.
Free speech, is it an actual reality, or is it just a talking point that people use in this country?
It's a right, and we got to like really lean into it and own it. And I think, you know, the idea that so many colleagues pick and choose when that right is activated is incredibly interesting, but also just very telling of them. I mean, we take an oath to uphold the United States Constitution. I have been in spaces, the most disgusting, hateful things spewed out at me at, you know, town halls and coffee hours. And I always tell the crowd when they get upset, no, they have a right. You know, don't, this is not how we should react. And I said, everyone I represent has a right to express what they feel and what they believe in. And we shouldn't boo that. We shouldn't push back against it. And usually we'll calm people, but understanding like that's what makes our country uniquely different. Is that, you know, this is sometimes, I mean, you can't in other countries say what you want, you get imprisoned, or, you know, and again, some will claim that that's still happening here in different ways. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we have to really lean into that right. And that First Amendment right, let me tell you, it's also the right to boycott, which people want to separate. That is one of the most peaceful right to resist, you know, things that you don't believe in. You know, folks will push back against the use of child labor and boycott a company, or you know, push back against an industry that is not treating its workers right. So, you know, again, that is also part of our freedom, our First Amendment freedom of speech and assembly, and so much more. So,
And the whole world is been captivated, for lack of better terms, I guess, by the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, especially since last year. Can you give me just a brief synopsis of the history? How far back are we talking?
I mean, it depends on who you talk to, but I mean, look, as a member of Congress right now, you know, realizing I'm the only Palestinian American serving in Congress, even hearing in my Democratic caucus, just how little they know about Palestinians or what happened in 1948 with the Nakba. You know, Nakba is referred to as, you know, people don't like, but that's the actual historic terminology of what they call the catastrophe, which, you know, 800,000 Palestinians were uprooted from their homes. Thousands undocumented, like, were killed and never seen before. Men were rounded up in villages and never seen before. You know, my grandparents hardly talked about, they were young, but they hardly talked about it, but they just remember, you know, the amount of fear of will we be next? Will our village be taken? And when you say village, I'm talking about lit homes. These are, many of them were farming villages. They mm-hmm. they relied on their olive trees to make olives and sell and fig tree. I mean, they had all kinds of different things that they were growing and known for. But one of the things that, you know, I did, I've only introduced one piece of legislation specifically around Palestine, and it was the Nakba resolution, mm-hmm. primarily because I want to imagine folks to know this. When I would speak up and say, oh, no, that's not true. Actually, my grandfather was shot 11 times for not leaving his home in the late 1960s. And I said, you know, it is a real thing. Where colleagues are like, but what does occupation mean? You know, we use this terminology that they're not familiar with. What do you mean checkpoint? Explaining to them, you know, me as a little girl, 11-year-old girl, going through this checkpoint with my grandmother and watching the other line where everybody looked lighter skinned, different, you know, and then here we are. And you know, my grandmother was a farmer. She wore her like Palestinian embroidered like thobe with her basket going to the market, and we're going into the, like, we're in the West Bank, we're in the, going to the city in the West Bank and still being searched, stopped. You know, I remember my grandmother's face, just like her head, she's already a short woman, and she just crumbled by the time we got on the other side. And I think it was because I was watching so attentively, and like, it was the first time I realized that my grandmother just was being othered or being dehumanized right in front of my eyes. All that to say is 1948 is what many majority of Palestinians would refer to as when the indigenous community, the Palestinian community, Muslim, Christian, and we had a lot, I mean, there was people of Jewish faith that were Palestinian. My grandfather would pick olives next to his Jewish neighbor who's considered themselves Palestinian Jew. And so all that to say is, like, all of a sudden things shifted, power dynamics shifted, and all of a sudden they were not full citizens or for full, you know, I said to people all the time in my caucus, all the time, mm-hmm. the only crime my grandmother ever committed was being born Palestinian. If she was born within maybe a different faith, she would be given equal rights. She would be able to live freely on her land. To be left alone to go to the doctor's office without having to go through checkpoints or having to not be able to leave because they have, I mean, people told me about like over 17 year, what do they call it when you can't leave? They would basically say you could not leave your house from this time to this time. I mean, can you imagine?
A curfew.
Curfew. He's a Nakba survivor. So I did the Nakba resolution primarily because people would say to me, you don't know the history. People within my caucus. And I'm like, I can set three to four generations of my family in Palestine. And you're telling me my ancestor, like I'm literally descended of my ancestors that I don't know the history. Like my ancestors lived the history. My grandmother lived the history. And so I introduced the NECPA resolution as saying, let's talk about the history. People were in uproar. They wouldn't, the Republicans canceled my event. They wouldn't let me have, McCarthy kept canceling and saying I couldn't have my event. And all I did wanted to bring NECPA survivors that were like children that are 8, 9 years old when the NECPA happening, talking about suffering from hunger and separation of families, not being able to go home to the homeland, like having nothing mm-hmm. but what they had on their backs. And, you know, even at that moment talking, he mentioned about, we couldn't even live our lives for 17 years. We had, or he said 17, I think it was over a decade, but he was just describing the fact that from this time to this time, you couldn't leave your home. He said you almost imprisoned within on your own land in your own home. He said it was horrifying. People, it was to force people to leave, and people started leaving saying we can't live like this. Definitely what I try to do is humanize the Palestinian people and talk about them. I mean, in the way of my family, and I kid you not, y'all, like I want everybody to know my family is so legit, like humble, chill. My mom's side, not my dad's, but my mom's side. My mom's side is like, you know, they got that kind of Southern feel to them. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, want to drink their tea underneath their olive tree, be left alone to live their lives. I still remember when my grandmother was alive and my Siti was asked by some media outlet, hey, you know, they said the forever impeached president's name and said, you know, he said this about your granddaughter. You know, luckily my grandmother wasn't on Facebook. She's pretty much illiterate. She never went to school. She couldn't read or write. And so she really didn't pay attention too much and what was happening or was said about me. Of course, you know, the previous president used to pick on me a lot. And so this person translates to her what he said about me. And she goes, what? She was so shocked. And then they ask her like a trick question. Well, would you let him come to your house? And she said, he can come, but he comes as a man, not as president of the United States. Mm. And I said to someone, that's just my incredible Palestinian family that, you know, they have never, ever seen them, other people, anything. If anything, even when they complain, they did it in a way of like, God, I'm praying for folks that think that we're a threat. But I'm praying for those people that don't understand what they're doing to children and families. That's just how they've always consistently approached, living under apartheid.
Mm-hmm. Now, okay, so the latest clip from you was the Fox News reporter.
Oh, yeah. And I'm sorry. It wasn't from me. It was her.
from the media sphere.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting here looking at it, and I'm like, okay, I completely get not talking to Fox. But the question she asked,
oh yeah,
was about the Death to America chants. And I'm also thinking, would it just be simpler to just say I condemn it?
No, because I don't want to talk. Because no matter what I say, the fact that she's asking me the question, even though within hours the mayor of Dearborn put out a statement that I refer to, the fact that over a dozen organizations within the community and leaders had issued statements basically calling it out for what it is and saying that the community has been expressing issues regarding this organization, and the community turned into FBI agents and doxed the guy, reported him to the FBI. All this is never going to be public on a channel like that, because why? They want to feed into it. Like, interesting enough, the person that broke it, mm-hmm. Put it out there in the right-wing media, is the same guy that authored that awful, awful Islamophobic op-ed in the Washington Post. And so all that to say is I'm proud of our community speaking up. Before Gaza, they've been talking about, I mean, there's a reason there was no elected officials at this event, because this is an organization and folks, by the way, the guy that was running the rally or whatever, went out, did a Instagram, you know, a video condemning the leaders for condemning him. All that to say is, I just wish people would know all of that. They don't, and no one's going to report it. You know, I heard local media say, yeah, over a dozen organizations within hours calling this out, saying this is wrong. Did they quote them? Did they interview them? Did they even care to allow them? Because let me tell you, the residents in the community immediately was like, whoa, they're going to think we're all like that. Like we don't support that. And putting their lives in danger because people are feeding into this Islamophobic trope. The guy that started the chant is a guy that everyone, like I called the FBI and I said, yo, you know, twice I've told, you know, people have told you about this person who came from Ohio. And of course there was a lot of jokes online about like, you know, he needs to go back to Ohio because we're from Michigan, but no one cares to tell the true story that many of the people of Muslim faith, I don't care if it was the folks that in Buffalo who exposed that cell. And, you know, it was the Yemeni community that spoke up there proudly and saying, hey, something's wrong here. You guys should go. I asked the authorities that I was like, this is not the first time somebody's expressed concern. I heard, and I mentioned some names, express concern to you all in meetings about, you know, some of the rhetoric and really just uncomfortableness that people were feeling being around some of these folks that would just show up. And like, we're like, wait, what is this person doing here? And now I heard he's out there fishing around and passing literature out. And I'm like, why is it that you're, you know, I don't know if he's a convert. I don't know what it is that makes them not. Why don't you knock on his door and ask him some questions about whether or not he has, you know, any, you know, if he's a threat to our country. And again, you know, you do it in a way that is within the law. But there's too many people they were not surprised. Too many people were like, oh, yeah, there's that guy again. And I was like, whoa. And then when I told them everybody in Dearborn turned into FBI agent, catch up, FBI, they laughed at me. And I said, no, you know, they just doxed him online. And he's like, what? I said, yeah, we all got his address is out there. Everything's about him is out there.
So
I was like, why aren't we doing anything about it? I mean, I just wish the public would care about seeing that side of the community that's like, mm-mm. Like, of course, we're against the genocide and we want to free the Palestinian people and we want wars to end. We don't want suffering to happen. But we don't ignite this kind of rhetoric that, to me, is incredibly dangerous. We all live here, so
absolutely. Yeah. You wake up tomorrow, and hypothetically speaking, you're the president. How do you fix the planet?
Oh, I don't know.
How do you fix America?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think about my district and what we've been able to do. You know, when I always tell people this, and this is so important. You know, folks think like transformative change, like we got the Civil Rights Act because the president of the United States woke up one day or Congress said, I think the Civil Rights Act is a really good thing. That didn't happen. No. People marched, they boycotted, they put themselves on the line. They pushed from the outside in. You think about the right to vote. It wasn't like, oh, the president woke up one day and said, really think Black folks should have the right to vote. And we should have no barriers. You think that didn't happen? The same thing with right to organize unions. You think the Congress said we need to have the right to organize unions and people in the workplace should have that right? It should be protected under the law? No, it's because workers withheld their labor and demanded it. And many died demanding that human dignity.
Were murdered.
And so, yeah. And so I remind people this because we are, you know, I don't want this culture being built of this one person is like our savior, this one person. Mm-hmm. Now, if anybody was to be president, is to listen to their people, like really listen to movement folks and folks out there right now that are saying things like cease fire and save our planet and healthcare for all, please, you know, I'm filing, but you know, get families filing bankruptcy because they can't afford, like they couldn't afford to get sick and they got sick. It's not their fault. And now, you know, they're in financial crisis. So all that to say is that I hope that when people think about that top of the ticket or think about these individuals, that like we have a tremendous amount of power on the inside pushing them using the ballot box, but also doing year long pushing, knocking on these doors and saying, hey, that's not what you need to be doing, this or that. Like, the, you know, and again, organizing outside and raising the consciousness of the American people on these issues. That's how we got transformative change in our country. I could have never imagined, I kid you not, yes, George Floyd, justice and policing didn't get passed out of the Senate. But out of the House, if somebody was to tell me, oh, we were going to pass it out of the House, majority Democrats, I think all, and a handful of Republicans were going to vote for it, I would have never believed it. But people would not stop marching. They would not stop talking about George Floyd, not talking about police brutality. And it was incredible to see that all of a sudden the shift in Congress, and it was proof to me what I learned in Detroit. You know, Grace Lee Boggs and all these folks would like tell us we are the what can push these institutions where we need to be. And I kid you, I could have never imagined a bipartisan support of George Floyd and Justin Policing that addressed immunity, accountability, like really, really significant changes around police accountability. And it was because people wouldn't stop showing up to folks' town halls, marching. And I mean, it was such a consistent drumbeat that even in that short period of time, all of a sudden, Republicans were like, yeah, this might be a good thing.
And I know I'm over time, so I do apologize.
Oh, that's okay.
But I'm old enough to remember when Detroit and Dearborn were two different worlds.
Oh, yeah.
It's such a beautiful thing now to see the harmony. Not that everybody, you know, that's not everybody sitting around playing Kumbaya, I mean, singing Kumbaya, but to see the oneness that has developed over time. It's just a beautiful thing.
Well, I think the younger generation, you know, I'm a Detroiter. Everybody thinks I grew up in Dearborn, and this is my first year representing Dearborn. And I even was anxious about it. I mean, everyone kind of knew I was, even though a lot of my family members live there. I work there. I organize around immigrant rights and civil liberties issues there. But, you know, of course, now I'm such a mama bear. I'm very protective of all my corners, even Livonia. Like, I don't care where, if you live in my district, I am very, no, but I am super protective of my constituents. I don't care if you live in Bingham Farms, Southfield, Livonia, Dearborn, Westland, Garden City. And so, you know, I just don't want my residents ever to feel one less than or not supported or really being heard. But I can tell you in the last now almost year and a half that I go in June will be a year and a half that I represent Dearborn. I find that there's been a generational shift where I'm finding that young people who are integral part of, you know, movement for Black lives, environmental justice movement. I see, like, even in my community, in the Yemeni community, more and more talking about how do we work with other communities being impacted by pollution. And so, you know, it just reminds me of what Pastor Bland Jr. taught me early on. I mean, sitting in his pew in his church in Liberty Temple, and I remember him looking right at me and saying, our country is not divided, it's disconnected. And at that moment, I'm finding ways to try to connect Dearborn families and residents to understand some of the connectivity of how they're feeling, not, like neglected or left out in various policymaking, things like that. And how we can learn so much from this incredible, beautiful Black city that I was raised in. And I'm always reminding them of, you know, that it was always Black mothers that told my mother to raise her voice when she used to be whispery. Or that if you think of moments of knocking down barriers, it was a lot of our Black neighbors at the forefront of doing that opened up so many doors for so many other folks. And that, you know, I said this very clearly at one event, like, we got to stop waiting until it's our community. Like, that's being targeted, like, to speak up when it's other communities as well. Absolutely. And yeah, I'm almost a young Muslim woman said, Rashida, how come nobody's saying anything? It's 2016. Young girl, she might have been 16, 17. And she's like, Sister Rashida, how come nobody's saying anything about what he's saying about Muslims? And I said, Sister, this is not just for you. It's a big hall. I was on a panel with Congressman Dan Kildee, and this is before I ran for office for Congress. And I said, well, how many of you all said anything when he said Mexicans were rapist? And you can almost hear a pin drop. So my point to them was, well, we can't wait until all of a sudden he's talking about us.
Yeah.
You got to be speaking up when he's talking about someone else as well. You know, like, we can't continue to do that. Pastor Bland's right. We got to connect our movement, understanding that what white supremacists and those that want us to buy, they are scared when we all come together. It's one of their biggest fears of us coming together, uniting around true liberation in our country and really feeling completely like safe and free to be who we are.
Yeah. Why the Living Wage for Musicians Act?
Oh, and during the pandemic, these young musicians met with me, you know, virtual. And, you know, of course I took the meeting, you know, they're my constituents. And I don't know what I expected, but in that meeting, I got really angry, but emotional, and not realizing just like, this is really, I didn't realize that it was going to take like 85% of the music industry is streaming now. And that these young, and you know, these are independent artists, local artists, gospel singers, jazz singers. These are also the individuals that help produce, that are around behind the scenes creating music. And I found out it took them 1,000 streams on Spotify, Apple Music, whatever, to even afford a cup of coffee. 800,000 streams for them to actually be able to have a living wage. And so all of that to say is they said, we really suffered during in the pandemic because we actually made up for the lack of really being able to provide for us and our families. Many of them have families that because we had events, we had live events, we did events. It was a hard work, but that's what we did. But we couldn't do that during COVID. We couldn't do it during the shutdown. And so it's not like they can go back and make up for those hours, that time, those days to get those wages back, or the money back from what they lost during that time. And so it was a lot of conversations about the fact that, you know, there was so much help for restaurant workers, so much help for restaurant industry, so much help for the hotel industry, so much for event venues. But what about the artist? And so that was a couple of years ago, and we introduced a resolution after meeting with them and worked with them directly. And then later on, you know, United Musicians and Allied Workers Union worked with us very closely and developed the Living Wage Musicians for Musicians Act, and to create not only a movement to understanding, we got to be able to tackle on the fact that the music industry has changed significantly, but also using it to educate folks and people that, you know, may click and download these apps and not realizing the artist that they love is suffering right now or challenged and not being able to make a living wage. And so we've been using it. We've had nonstop, I kid you not, within a couple hours of introducing the bill, over 14,000 people had signed the petition in support of the bill. We've gotten outreach from around the country saying, thank you. Thank you for raising awareness that people, because people, even at a coffee, I was at a, like did a coffee town hall in Northwest Detroit, and somebody got up and said, you know, my cousin was like, yo, your doesn't live here, but your congresswoman just introduced this. And he's like, what is it? I explained, when I told the crowd that 1,000 streams is when they can afford a cup of coffee, people were like, and I said, yeah. And it's about time that we can't continue to allow, you know, Spotify, many of these industries to make record profit while the people that are people that are on their apps, on their platforms, making pennies.
Yeah. So the next one, this is my theory on why the auto insurance is ridiculous in Detroit specifically. Detroit has Coleman Young knew the value of the water and being in control of a big chunk of other cities receiving their water.
Yeah.
Since then, there has been a concerted effort to remove that power from Detroit, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. And what they came up with was raising the insurance rates for your car, because what mm-hmm. people end up doing.
That's an interesting theory. I haven't heard that one before.
I've been working with this for a while now. But what people end up doing is they started getting insurance. Their cousin lives in Southfield. Mm-hmm. So they get their driver's license in Southfield. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now you can't vote in Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
So they're circumventing, you know, voters' rights and everything with a back door.
Mm-hmm.
You sponsored a bill to prevent auto insurance discrimination. What was your rationale for that? What happened with that bill?
Yeah, I'll tell you. So this is my third cycle introducing it. By the way, the number of supporters increases. So we, you know, me and her name is Congresswoman Bonnie Watson Coleman. She's out of New Jersey. New Jersey mm-hmm. has really high auto insurance as well. I like looked it up. There's about a dozen that are almost up to what we have. Even those that don't have no fault process within their state, are all they see is just skyrocketing of auto insurance. So what happened is University of Michigan, they're called Poverty Solutions, did a study that showed that auto insurance rates in Michigan kept people in the cycle of poverty. 90% of zip codes in Michigan were unaffordable auto insurance rates. So it's not a, you know, people, of course, I always tell folks, yeah, you see it become a Detroit issue, right? Mm-hmm. You know, this is a Detroit issue. Lead in water. Guess what? Lead in water is in your backyard. Guess what? It's in your backyard now. Auto insurance increases. And then, you know, even I remember driver's license responsibility fee. Everyone knew this was about targeting, you know, it was very clear that it was disparate impact, that it was targeting predominantly people of color that drove. And all of a sudden, driver's license responsibility fee was starting to impact folks in Grand Rapids and other areas. And all of a sudden, then they're like, oh, we should probably reform that, because that's why it had the whole overhaul and elimination driver's license. But it took everybody being impacted by it. So University of Michigan did this study, because this is brought up in a, I don't care if I'm doing a town hall, Livonia, Dearborn, anywhere in my district, they will bring, Southfield will bring up auto insurance now. So I read that someone with a DUI, drinking under the influence violation, compared to somebody with no DUI, was paying three times less than the person with no DUI. Why? Because the person with no DUI had a less credit score than the person. So the guy with the higher credit score, but a DUI, drinking under the influence, should be paying more than somebody with no violation. So these non-driving factors, marital status, what does that have to do with anything? Congresswoman Debbie Dingell gave me permission to tell people, when John Dingell passed away, she became a widow. Her auto insurance went up $1,000. Of course she fought it, but $1,000, why? You know, I mean, it's not like, it's like she's driving. I mean, nothing's changed other than she's now the driver. He wasn't even driving back then. So like, it is so bizarre. The fact that they're asking for educational level, why somebody with a PhD drives better than somebody with a high school diploma? I don't get it. These are non-driving, these are proxies to discriminate, period. Somebody with a DUI, with a higher credit score, should be paying more because they have a driver's related violation. Somebody with a lower credit score, why are they paying such a significant amount of money? I remember days where they used to ask you, how far are you driving? What kind of car are you driving? Do you have any tickets? Now they ask marital status, education level, credit score. Like now they're saying, oh, we're going to only look up your credit history. What's the difference? Stop playing games. You're looking at things up. And you should see the Congresswoman Maxine Waters got me a hearing on this issue, my first term, because we all got to pick an issue. And I said, Congresswoman, this is my issue. Mm-hmm. And I explained to her, I showed her. Like I want to bring the University of Michigan in. I want them to talk about the fact that we can see very clearly, very good driver, no history of issues with a person with a bunch of history. The only thing is this person is higher income, education level. So why is this person why is this person being discriminated against, primarily on around income class, and majority probably are on vulnerable communities. Mm-hmm. So the point is, prohibiting Auto Insurance Discrimination Act exposes what I've been saying. Now, the auto insurance industry came and testified in the committee. I kid you not. Do you know, I called them out. I said, I heard what you said. You said it's better for them to be paying for auto insurance than for drugs and music and alcohol. Now, if that wasn't a racist remark and trope, you know, they're feeding into this rhetoric in the minds of sets of my colleagues. I know it. But even as I talked to them, I said, that's not, oh, it's not these non-driving factors. Of course, they don't call it that. They said, these are good indicators of whether or not they're going to be good drivers. I said, how? Explain to me the connection of somebody's credit score is whether or not they're going to be a good driver. That doesn't make sense. Why is somebody with a clean record paying so much more? And then they're charging them also, like, so say that you're low income and you can't do the yearly, you can only do monthly. And that's real, okay? You know, because they expect you to pay a certain amount. They're discriminating against those folks. They're literally getting insurance that's required by law in Michigan to be able to drive. We don't have mass transit. We have so this idea around the cycle of poverty, but also the fact that the auto insurance industry has gotten away with using these non-driving factors to really target working class communities of color, predominantly Black, Latino communities are seeing the highest rate increases than any other community.
Yeah. And I am being told that I have went over time. So yeah. They're like, shut up. Okay, I'm shutting up.
Me too. I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Oh, I could talk to you forever. So I do apologize. I've got a gazillion things to do. This has been such an honor and one I will never forget.
Thank you.
I'm absolutely certain there's nothing on the planet I could possibly do for you. However, if one day in 10 years you wake up and say, I need something from that guy, I got you. is there anything you want to say before we wrap it up?
Oh, just, you know, just for all of my residents, but all of everybody around that. I know you already know this, but, you know, I just want people, as they think about these issues and think about what they're seeing on national media and everything, dig a little deeper to get to know folks, because some of the same people that you might be supporting as elected office, it doesn't translate into some of the actions they're doing. Watch how people act and what the work that they're putting into it. It should be equally as important, because I really believe Congress shouldn't only look differently, but it should feel differently, act differently, and speak differently. And that's really important. And I just want people to fully like embrace that, like pay attention to everything that is happening. I say this because I get people come up to me all the time like, oh, you're from Detroit. Oh, you're, you know, and you can see the surprise in their face, because whatever the national narrative out there is of trying to gaslight people about who I am, I just hope people take a moment and really find out for themselves.
Well, I hope they watch this yeah. Conversation and enlighten themselves a little bit. I do appreciate you.
Thank you.
You are absolutely welcome back anytime. And you have a phenomenal day on purpose.
Oh, thank you so much. I like that. You too.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Take care. Yeah, bye.
Yo, that is absolutely, that's a bucket list interview right there. Very, very open, as you can tell, and just a beautiful spirit. And you know, the crazy part is, and I didn't get a chance to talk about it, but I can talk about it now. I tried to buy an ad on Instagram, and all I did was post a flyer of her appearance today at 9:00. You know, they rejected me. It didn't pass the social something. I don't know what the, but I didn't have like some inflammatory speech behind it, or, you know, some boogeyman stuff going on. No, they just rejected it. Just flat out. It was weird. Anyway, salute to my manager, Rita. You are the GOAT. I'm going to tell you time and time again. You have been such a blessing to Intellectually Petty Radio. I cannot possibly adequately thank you enough. you got a fan for life, and whatever you need, I'm always rocking with you. Anyway, on that note, this has been Jobs. This has been another episode of Intellectually Petty Radio, and I'm out. Y'all have a good one.